That's huge. That's like one of the biggest topics and challenges, I think, especially around innovation in Japan. I think that is where a lot of that stem, well, most of it, I would say that's the single biggest reason why it's so hard to get innovation out of Japan. Because Japan, as you know, they create very, very high quality products, right? A lot of the world has caught up now, but previously they're known for high quality automobiles, electronics, right, at good prices too, right? And they didn't invent them, but they really perfected the Six Sigma process, the lean process, like all of those processes. Even though they weren't invented in Japan, Japan really adopted them and perfected them, right? And so they're able to engineer like crazy these things and like perfect their products, right? Which is great for more finished products to create and sell those. It's horrible for innovation, actually, right? Because that whole philosophy is about no errors, no flaws, no mistakes, and really driving risk out of the process. Whereas innovation is completely opposite, where you actually want to fail a lot, right? You fail 9 times out before you get to that 10th success, right? It's messy, right? You really don't know where you're going to end up before you start. Like you got to start not knowing where you're headed even, and then you just go, and then you figure it out as you're going, which is not what you want to do if you want to make a really good product that doesn't have any mistakes in it, right?
Iki Conversation showcases a purpose-driven leader from the Ikigai Knowledge Institute, also known as Iki, a collaborative network that supports the cultivation and sustainability of each member's Ikigai while galvanizing collective efforts to drive positive impact. This conversation spotlights the leadership path to purpose and includes Q&A from members of the Iki network. Today's guest is Akio Hashi, Vice President at Evolution VC, a venture firm that works between Japan and the U.S., and a seed member at Infinity Point CDFI, a community development financial institution that helps legacy businesses convert to worker-owned enterprises. Aki's mission is to support entrepreneurs and businesses that are creating positive social and environmental impact, especially in the Asia-Pacific region. His three core values are kindness, optimism, and adventure. And Aki, welcome to Iki Conversations. To kick things off, can you please provide some context on these three core values: kindness, optimism, and adventure, and how they resonate with your leadership journey?
Yeah, thank you, Sam. Thank you. It's great to be here. Yeah, it's interesting how when these three core values, you were going through this exercise to pick them. Just to give background, there's a pretty large list, and then you basically start going through and eliminating them, and then the three that are left are apparently your core values. But thinking about them though, and looking at them, they fit quite well. Surprise, surprise. Yeah, I mean, I think the one I'll start with, I wouldn't say it's necessarily the most important, but I'll just start with adventure. I kind of that's I feel like that's been a philosophy or a value through my entire life. I always like to look for new things, try new things. I'm pretty excited about discovering and things happening. And I think that's I don't know if we'll touch upon this or not. That's probably why I spent almost 6+ years in undergrad studying architecture, and then worked in the field for about a year before I quickly jumped into the startup ecosystem and this kind of adventure, right? Fast moving. But then the other two, right? Kindness and optimism. I think those are the pieces that are really important to me to have while I'm experiencing these new adventures, right? I think it's not worth having these new adventures and not worth doing what I'm doing if I don't do it through the lens of kindness and optimism, right? Always looking kind of not unrealistically, but always looking kind of at the positive of things, right? Because as you're exploring new things, there's always going to be ups and downs, but always trying to look at the positive and trying to look at what's good about a certain situation, and then doing it out of kindness and doing it with people that I enjoy being with, such as this group here, and enjoying that kind of adventure, not just doing it for the sake of doing it, and just really having a good time while doing it.
I love that. That's great context. Thank you for sharing. So adventure. So I'll just come back to the point that you the narrative or the story that you started on. So background in architecture, studied architecture, did it for a year, and it wasn't scratching the adventure itch. So
That's right.
can you share a little bit more context on that?
It's funny thinking back. I mean, the school, the architecture schooling was so fantastic. And if I had to do it all over again, I would probably just do that. That I think now looking back, there's adventure there, right? We're in the studio like 24/7, just designing things, building things, like physically building things out of paper, cardboard, wood, even metal, right? Doing drawings, rendering on the computer. So it's very stimulating, right? And discovering new things. But then in the real world, it's a little bit different, right? You're especially starting off in your career, you are designing, bathrooms and closets and toilets, and then taking those to the city to get, permits and code review and things like that, right? So not very adventurous there. And then all while I was doing that, right after I graduated undergrad, was when the dot-com boom was happening. And I had just moved from I was went to school at Texas and University of Texas, and I just moved from Austin to San Francisco for the first time. I'm now here for the second time, but it's my first time to be here in San Francisco. The dot-com boom was going on. There's just a frenzy of activity and startups, and I realized, I really love technology and innovation and kind of the fast pace of the startup world. And so I was just really quickly drawn into this space, hopped over to a startup. And then amazingly, that startup, maybe not amazingly for that time, because they pretty much all did this, but the startup went IP, went public, which is a fantastic ride up. And then also, as most people know, is a fantastic, a pretty dramatic ride down. But it was a great experience, right? Like really enjoyed that. I really learned a lot, and that really built the foundation for what I'm doing today.
That's a good segue. So, thanks for the context. What can you provide some background on both of the roles that we talked about, VP at Evolution BC and seed member at Affinity Point Seed?
Sure. Yeah. So at Evolution, I'll just give the quick summary. It's a venture capital firm. It's relatively new too, so we haven't been around that long. But it's very focused on Japan. And my background is my parents are Japanese. I was born and raised in the US. But I obviously, of course, I had always had that kind of in the background, that was my heritage. My parents spoke Japanese, although of course we spoke English back to them in the house. But I always had that. And so this is quite later. So after all the dot-com stuff, after grad school, I had a chance to move and work in Japan for about 5 years total, and kind of polished my language skills, my Japanese language skills, built a pretty good network, also in the venture and startup space in Japan, and then now moved back to the U.S. Here in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area. But Evolution is a VC firm. All of our investors, all of our LPs, our limited partners, are Japanese companies, Japanese corporations. They're not even funds. We purposely selected big companies to be our investors, like Mitsubishi or NTT. And the reason for that is we raise all our money from Japanese companies, invest in mostly US, some European, but no Japanese startups, right? We purposely invest outside of Japan, and then we try to take those startups back to Japan when it makes sense for business purposes. So there's a lot of strategic value that our investors can get or will, should get out of the investment, and not just a financial return, because that's not really where we want to focus. And I think that's another part of for us and for me, right? I really enjoy being somewhat involved in that operating part of it, not on a day-to-day basis, but helping these companies figure out, should they enter a new market like Japan? If so, then how would they do it? Who would they partner with? Who should they hire? Things like that. And so assisting in that operational role. And so there's that kind of very strong tie between US and Japan. And that Japan piece has been prevalent throughout that first startup, not so much, but pretty much everything else, there was a really strong Japan theme to it. as well as this kind of startup and innovation and early stage technology. So that's kind of the evolution piece. That's my full-time, my day thing. And then the Infinity Point is more of a side hustle. It's 100% volunteer, right? So there's nothing, no financial, return for that, at least at this point. But basically, it does that piece actually doesn't have too much to do with Japan, but it's as you described, it's a nonprofit that is helping other small and medium sized companies, and not these tech startups that I deal with in my day, with Evolution. It's more around family owned businesses, restaurants, small manufacturing, so more blue collar type companies, and helping them when the founder owner decides that they want to sell, right? They want to exit. Instead of selling to another person or another company, or maybe even a PE fund, they can actually sell it back to the employees, right? And you don't just kind of give them, the keys to the company immediately, but there's a whole structure and a whole process, right? You bring in a trust and blah, blah, blah. And then the employees over time, they will slowly get, small pieces of ownership of that company. And then in the long run, it's actually, if you do it right, you could actually do it really, really wrong too. But if you do it right, it could be much better for the company. Employees are now much more vested, right? They own pieces of it. And they realize at first, they're not going to think twice about it. But after a year or two or three, they start looking at their accounts and being like, oh, wow, I actually own shares in this company that I work at. And it's also appreciating in value, right? And so they see that kind of impact. And, previously, these are typically, just 9-to-5 jobs, right? People kind of clock in, they do their time, they can't wait to get off, and then they go and they don't think about work again until they show up the next day. Whereas now they're part owners, right? And so they're vested in trying to improve the business. They're thinking about ways to make things better, doing the extra thing, right, as an owner, right? And so the company does better. Of course, it's better for the employees. Now they have a retirement plan. And then also the community, right? Because these are typically based in, of course, they're in some community, and they serve, if it's a restaurant or a small man, they serve the community. And so the community around the businesses improves. And so we feel like it's a much better way to do capitalism. And originally the founders of Infinity Point, he always jokes, he's like, I was really trying to improve democracy. But I realized that was going to be too big of a challenge. And so I just settled for trying to improve capitalism. So, but yeah, I mean, he jokes about that, but I think, if this catches, and there's a lot of benefits to it, to convert to these employee owned structures, there's a lot of tax benefits. So you get a lot back from the IRS. And like I said, the company, the employees are much more vested in them, and they grow much faster in a lot of cases.
Yeah, that sounds like a very mission-driven, purpose-driven effort. Can you provide a little bit of context on just how you found your way to Infinity Point and just why it resonates with your journey?
Yeah, I guess this is it's funny. These values, haven't really thought about them so much before. The way I got to Infinity Point was when a little bit of a long story. I try to keep it short, but when COVID started, obviously we couldn't go out, we couldn't go meet people. I realized I was, I have more of an extroverted tendency, and so I like meeting new people, I like kind of interacting. I get energy from talking to other folks. And then when we couldn't go out, couldn't go to conferences, couldn't do meetings face to face, I realized that that was a big piece that was missing. And so I joined this networking platform called Lunch Club, which is a virtual online. Basically, they just match you up with people and then they say, here, have a conversation. And, they have an algorithm that tries to find the right match. I don't know how well it works. It matches up with great people, but I don't know if it's the algorithm or not. And then they have the whole infrastructure. So they, you set the time, right? So it's pretty easy, right? You just sign up and then they find you a person. And in fact, I had a couple calls yesterday. And then you just have a good conversation. And one of the founders, there's two co-founders, but one of the founders of Infinity Point was on Lunch Club. And so that's how I met him. Met a ton of other people too. That's a whole nother topic I could talk a lot about. But yeah, so I met him through that, and then we got to talking. He's like, "Oh, it sounds like there's a lot of alignment here. Would you be interested in coming aboard this new?" It was a pretty new organization. I was a second member to join. It's been now 3 year, four, 3 year years. Yeah, so years now. So there's a big, a nice core group of us now. But yeah, that's how I got involved.
Great. Makes a lot of sense. I mean, I've seen other initiatives that are focused on employee ownership. Actually, one in particular comes to mind in the Bay Area called Project Equity. And they have a lot of proof that just how that supports not only obviously ownership transformation, but the community that small business supports. So let's go back to Evolution VC. So can you talk a little bit more about just your journey to Evolution VC? It's super fascinating to me that the LPs are all Japanese companies. We've talked previously about how, in some ways, it kind of serves as the innovation, incubation, R&D, some form of that. But that seems like a relatively unique concept. Just in general in the VC space, but can you maybe talk a little bit about that, and then just also how you found your way to Evolution VC?
Thank you. So, as I mentioned, I had a chance to live after grad school, moved to Japan. I was there for about 5 years. I was both in a startup that I helped start with one of my business school classmates, Japanese guy. And then after that, I joined a VC, the VC that had funded that startup, actually. And so I did kind of both. And then I moved back here to the States and was still involved in technology and helping large Japanese companies with finding innovation, innovative ideas, technologies, business models, and things like that. And so I've been in kind of this venture, kind of new business space for a while. And I noticed that large Japanese companies are spending a lot of time and money in trying to get better connected with Silicon Valley, right? And Japan has been, their economy's been pretty flat for the last 30 years or so, 30, 40 years, right? They just raise their interest rate for the first time in 17 years, right? There's been negative interest rates for a while. Right now, it's at least slightly positive. So the economy has been stagnant, right? And a large reason for that is there's a lack of innovation, right? Ever since the Walkman was invented, there hasn't really been much new groundbreaking that has come out. A little bit of an exaggeration, right? But there's Japan's not known for, right? They didn't invent the iPhone, right? And they didn't really make the electric car a household thing, right? And so they've had a and there's a lot of reasons for this, but they've had a really tough time with innovation. So they've been looking quite a bit now at Silicon Valley to try to get some of that. But I noticed that they've been struggling a lot, right? It's really hard to come in here and get really connected with the good, the right networks. Silicon Valley, I always say, is there's a really open piece, meaning like you could come here, you could go to events, you could go to Stanford, you could go to Plug and Play. They have conferences and presentations, all the time, right? Several a week, if not every day. So you can come here and meet tons of people, and become part of a thriving and very exciting culture and ecosystem. But there's also a piece that's very closed, right? A lot of the kind of really hot deals, the ones that you read about in TechCrunch or even the New York Times, and a lot of the really big deals are not public. Like you don't get to be part of those conversations just because you live here, right? You have to know the right people. It's a very person to person, good or bad, right? But it's a very like personal networks type of thing, right? And if you're not in that, it's very hard, and it's very, very hard for Japanese companies to get in there, right? They're sending people over here typically for a 3 to 5 year rotation. And then they go home, right? And so you already know you're going home in 3 to 5 years. They're not really going to want to establish a close personal network relationship with you for the most part. And English is not that prevalent in Japan, right? And so English language is tough. And then there's a whole set of differences in the culture and the way business is done. And then how the speed of which things are done as well is very different, right? So there's all these kind of discrepancies, and so they've had a really hard time connecting with the startup ecosystem. And so we realized that if there are more people with kind of the experience of both living in Japan and in the US and startups and investing and also working in large companies, then we might be able to, people like that might be able to be good facilitators to help these large Japanese companies get better connected and work with startups. And then conversely, startups, right? A lot of startups, not everybody, but a lot of startups want to go to Japan. It's a very attractive and massive, it's a massive market that appreciates advanced technologies. So I felt like there would be a win-win, but there had to be somebody in between that do the handholding, right? Not just the language. The language is, nowadays you could solve it fairly easy for the most part with of course the interpreters, human interpreters, but the tools, right? The technology tools, the Google Translates and all the third-party tools out there now are so good, right? And they're only getting better. So it's not the language is not the big issue. I think it's kind of the culture and the mindset. And so they need, both sides, the Japanese corporations and the smaller Silicon Valley startups need somebody in between to help them kind of play nicely together, work well together, I guess. And so that's kind of where we see our role is we are investors and we try to find good startups that we think that will grow and exit. But really what we want to do is help the startups collaborate with the Japanese companies, help them work together, help them grow their businesses, both, their respective businesses, right? So they both succeed. And then ultimately, if that happens, then the fund will succeed. The fund will have good startups that exit. And so that's kind of our thesis is our hypothesis is that if we can create these cases of, strategic value, meaning like they actually do lots of business together and they work together, then the fund will be ultimately successful.
Makes a lot of sense. And that's an interesting observation about how it's less of a barrier of language, and that's becoming like smaller and smaller, and it's more of a culture thing. Both, obviously cultural norms, but you mentioned speed, like just the speed of implementation. If we start to talk about purpose and we integrate purpose into the conversation, can you just expand on how purpose finds its way? And I think with Infinity
Yes.
Point, that's pretty clear. But you can expand on that, but then also within Evolution VC.
Yeah. I think there's several levels, right? I think, one at the very kind of larger, higher level. I don't know if the right way to characterize it is, but my parents are from Japan. That's my heritage. That country has been struggling economically, in a certain way for a while, and so. The purpose there for me is really to kind of give back and help out there, right? I'd really love for the country that I came from to be more successful. And there's a lot of challenges over there. And I think that my experiences and some of the things that are happening over here might be helpful to them, right? And so I think that there's like kind of this larger, higher level purpose of trying to help a country and help them innovate. And then there's kind of the more kind of personal and I don't know if lower level is the right term, but kind of zooming in, I've been super fortunate to have been born and raised here and had great parents and had a great experience. Got to go to school, got to experience all these things, got to be in ventures now on the investment side, and I'd love to really give back to the next generation of folks and the young folks, the entrepreneurs, especially the Japanese entrepreneurs, right? Because there's so many of them that really want to try, but they don't have all the support that an entrepreneur here would have, right? Here, you kind of get dropped in. There's so many resources, accelerators, incubators, of course, the venture capitalists. There's money, there's technology, there's all the resources are right here. And that's why people come here, right, to the Bay Area. A lot of that doesn't exist in Japan, right? They don't have those experiences, they don't have that information, they don't have the people to look up to. And so part of that, my purpose is to kind of give back there and help the young next generation. And then just really more personal, I guess, is just like creating a great work environment for the people that I work to on a day-to-day basis, right? I aside from what I'm doing and what it's doing and how much money I make or whatever, really the most important thing to me is doing it in the right way with the people that I really enjoy doing it with. And I found that Evolution, I'm not one of the founders. There are three general partners that were the founders. And then I came in shortly after the company was founded, but I've known them for a while, even prior to when they set up Evolution. So, they're just such good people. I mean, I can't imagine like working with anybody else. It's really good people to work with, you know, very understanding, very kind of considerate, you know, just really good human beings. And in the VC world, especially kind of investments, and when you kind of get into money, there can be some, you know, not so great people, right? People in it for different reasons. And so we, you know, you have to kind of be aware of that. And if you don't like it, you need to figure out how to stand clear of that. And I feel like I've found a really, really good spot, even in an industry that can be known for having some, you know, a-holes. I found a really good core group of people that I really enjoy working with, that have like a really good, you know, they all have good purpose as well, I feel like. And so, so even, you know, like you said, Infinity Point is pretty easy to understand that kind of angle there, but I think that is also very prevalent in Evolution as well. And that's why I really enjoy what I'm doing and who I'm doing it with, most importantly.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. So the next generation and creating a great work environment is something that I really come to admire and appreciate about you. We met through the U.S.-Japan Council, which has a pretty strong commitment to next generation leaders and bilateral connection between U.S. and Japan. So, you know, that's definitely one of the missions of the organization, but it's something that I've really come to admire and appreciate about you. So you talked, I mean, you kind of jokingly said Walkman, you know, in terms of innovation was like the last innovative milestone. We talked recently about just what are the cultural inhibitors to innovation just in general. And one thing that you referenced that I've been thinking about a lot is just the fear of failure, or like the, maybe not fear of failure, not like just a acceptance of failure or whatever the right terminology is. Can you talk about that? Because I think that's a unique perspective that you bring, and just sitting in between these two worlds.
Yeah.
And I think it's especially important to people in the Western culture to even understand that as well, but it just takes on a different flavor when you incorporate.
Yeah. Thank you. That's huge. That's like one of the biggest topics and challenges, I think, especially around innovation in Japan. I think that is where a lot of that stems. Well, most of it, I would say that's the single biggest reason why it's so hard to get innovation out of Japan. Because Japan, as you know, they create very, very high quality products, right? You know, a lot of the world has caught up now, but you know, previously they're known for high quality automobiles, electronics, at good prices too, right? And they didn't invent them, but they really perfected the Six Sigma process, the lean process, like all of those processes, even though they weren't invented in Japan, Japan really adopted them and perfected them, right? And so they're able to engineer like crazy these things and like perfect their products, right? Which is great for more finished products to create and sell those. It's horrible for innovation, actually, right? Because that whole philosophy is about no errors, no flaws, no mistakes, and really driving risk out of the process. Whereas innovation is completely opposite, where you actually want to fail a lot, right? You fail 9 times out before you get to that 10th success, right? It's messy, right? You really don't know where you're going to end up before you start. Like you got to start not knowing where you're headed even, and then you just go, and then you figure it out as you're going. Which is not what you want to do if you want to make a really good product that doesn't have any mistakes in it, right? And I would say like the whole, that's just manufacturing products, but the whole society is kind of designed around that. If you ever go to Japan, you know, it's very clean, everything runs on time, everything is high quality, prices are good, right? All of society is really kind of designed around perfection and getting and reducing risk. And I think fear of failure is a really good term, right? They don't want to fail, right? If you fail, then that's seen as a really, really bad thing. And that, of course, then inhibits an entrepreneur from deciding, oh, I want to leave my really good job at NEC, for example, right? I've got a career thing. It's changing, but most, you know, a lot of people are still in the same company for their entire career, right? And if you decide to leave your company and become an entrepreneur, you're kind of jumping off of a train that's been kind of set up for you, right? It's not that you can never go back to corporate, right? Or you may, you know, it's not that you can never go back to NEC, for example, but you're never going to get on that same track that you were on before, right? And this, they have this whole thing set up for you when you first start. And so you leave, you get off, and your startup doesn't work out, which most of the time it won't, right? That's frankly the way it is. You have to find your own way, right? And people are not used to doing that, right? They're not used to, you know, sending out resumes and interviewing. That's just not in that culture, right? You don't, I mean, some people, you know, you only do it when you're an undergrad and then you join a company and that's it. You never have to do it again. A lot of people actually. And so people are not practiced in that area. And so they don't want to do it. And so the whole culture is not conducive, I guess, to this innovation, right? And to try and fail and things like that. And so that's kind of what we're trying to do is, you know, of course we don't want people to come in and then trail and fail and then everything, you know, then their options close down. What we're trying to do is then help people understand, like, if you want to succeed and you want to innovate, you have to create these spaces where people can fail. Right. So it's not just the individual. It's not just convincing, you know, person A to say, hey, you should go ahead and take that risk and start that startup, all right, or join that startup or whatever. It's more around, you know, telling big companies, right, that you've got to create a sandbox, right? You should create a sandbox where people are enabled to try new things and then maybe fail at a bunch of them before they find that next success. But even if they fail, they don't have this, you know, big black X on their record for the rest of their career, right? It's actually just part of, it's a badge, it should be a badge of honor, right? And so to change that mindset and culture, but also these systems, right, where they can set up these sandboxes, and not just the big companies, right, the government too. And they are starting to do things like that. It's very slow. So it's not like they're not doing any of that. But what we're trying to do is then help them do a little bit faster maybe and try some different things that they hadn't tried before.
Yeah, that's fascinating. There's so much that's fascinating about just the stigma attached to failure, the track that, like, the whole concept of creating a resume is one and done for your entire career. I think the average career tenure is like 4 years in the United States. It's just such a different perspective. I love the idea of also creating a sandbox where people can fail. If that's within the corporate structure, it helps all. So before I open it up for questions here, I'm curious about more on a personal level. You know, you were born in the U.S. You had Japanese parents. You went to live in Japan for 5 years. Can you talk about that experience of just being a U.S. citizen, a Japanese American, shinisei, right?
Yeah.
And immersing yourself into that environment. What was the driving force? I think it kind of have an inkling of what that looks like, but what was that experience like?
Yeah, you're asking all like the big questions. That was incredible, Sam, to put it frankly, because I was born here in the States, and I grew up in Texas, right, outside of Dallas, and then I went to school in Austin, right? So I thought I was white growing up, and then I got to move here to California after undergrad for the first time. I saw all these Asians around me. I was like, whoa, this is different. But yeah, when I first moved to Japan, like I said, like, we never really spoke Japanese in the house. Well, the kids didn't, the parents did, but we didn't speak back. And so, you know, my language skills were elementary school at best at that point. But fortunately, my parents had kind of instilled I like to say, like, the operating system for the Japanese language is also embedded into my head kind of subconsciously. And so, you know, the grammar, you know, all that grammar stuff, like, really hard. So that grammar, Japanese grammar is really hard if you're an English speaker. That was already there, right? The pronunciation and the listening were already, those neurons were already set. And so really for me, it was just a matter of learning vocabulary. And so I just spent hours in my free time just learning vocabulary. And so I went from landing in Japan and not knowing what they were saying, like on the news, Japanese news is they use much harder vocabulary than they typically do in the US English newscasts. So I would watch the news when I first got there. I had no idea what they're talking about. I could tell that it was Japanese, that they're speaking Japanese, but I had no idea. And the way the world kind of opened up to me as I started learning more of the vocabulary and getting used to the language was just like every day I would notice like, oh, now I know at least what the topic of that newscast was, right? I still don't know exactly what they're saying, but I know they were talking about the government or sports or whatever. I mean, of course you could tell by the footage too, but from the words I could tell like what they were talking about. And then I finally got to the point where I could understand everything, right? It was just like this world was like completely in a fog, and then just day to day, you could see that fog recede, which was as an adult to have learned something so much of something so quickly, the Japanese language in my case, was a really amazing experience. I mean, you do that, I think, all the time as a kid, but you don't really get to do that as an adult. So just learning that language there and just trying to fit in was amazing. And then the other big piece is, you know, like you said, like being Japanese American in Japan, it actually has a lot of challenges, right? Because in Japan, once you leave, you basically have left, right? And this kind of actually goes back to that story before about getting off the train. But once you leave the country too, you're really not considered Japanese. And so, you know, today I'm pretty close to like most people can't tell that I didn't even grow up in Japan if I'm talking to them. So I've been able to get my language skills up pretty high, but I still make sure if I'm talking to somebody, you know, the Japanese person or visiting in a company in Japan, that they realize that I'm not Japanese, right? So I do a lot of little things like on my business card. You know, in the East, you typically, it's your last name and then your first name is how, and people address you by your last name typically. But on my business card, even on the Japanese side of it, I have my first name first and last name last. It's similar to how they do it in the West, right? And so people can look at my business card right away, they're like, oh, this dude is not Japanese, right? Like he's not a normal Japanese guy, right? People would never do that in Japan. And so I try to make sure that I try to kind of use my experience to my advantage, right? Strategically, that I'm a you know, American that can speak really good Japanese, not a Japanese guy that, you know, has some stumbles, you know, speaking regular language, right? And so that kind of positioning is super important. And I try to figure out how to use that to my quote unquote advantage as much as possible. And the fact that I've lived in Silicon Valley for so long, that's a huge draw, right? That's a thing where like, oh, you live in Silicon Valley, what's that like, right? And so I kind of try to use that as a way to get my foot in the door. And then of course you have to have that kind of experience and all the insights, right, to then really make an impact, but to get your foot in the door and then kind of position yourself slightly differently, I think has really benefited me, and I, you know, really enjoy what I'm doing.
Man, there's so much I appreciate about that I could just take the rest of the airtime, but I will. We'll have to have a side conversation offline here. So we've got three questions in queue. I'm just taking a quick look at them. I think the one that Eliza asked. So Eliza, if you want to come off mute here, probably is a good segue, just based on what you're just talking about right there. So Eliza, if you want to ask that, and then we'll probably go Eliza, Tim Ryan.
Great. So much rich stuff, Aki. Thank you for sharing so many parts of your journey. You were talking about the fear of failure. Even before that, I was thinking about like everything. It comes back to your value of adventure is like you have such a high risk tolerance, like what you do every day, places you've been. And I just am like, how did you come to be? Like what happened in your life? Who did you interact with, like from your background? Just what do you think kind of created that way of approaching the world for you personally?
Yeah, thank you, Eliza. Unfortunately, I can't take credit for much of this myself. I think, you know, part of it is, I think it's in my genes. I just probably popped out that way. But the other piece you know, that's the nature part. The nurture part is, I would, you know, my parents, I just have to say my parents, they're so supportive. You know, they were there all the time. My dad worked, my mom was in the house, very typical Japanese family, but my dad was home like every day for dinner. Like he'd be back. They were around on the weekends. They're very supportive. I think they had a really good balance of being involved in things, but then also letting me kind of be free to explore things. But then also I always knew that they had my back, right? I always knew that if I tried something and it didn't work out, they would be supportive, right? And so they're always there. And I think with that kind of solid backing from the people that, you know, gave life to me, basically, well, not basically, that literally gave life to me, I think then that made me more comfortable taking these risks and be more adventurous. And I think, you know, every day I realize that I see, you know, other people that didn't have that, you know, didn't have that luck to have that in their background. And I think that does affect people, right? The kind of support you have when you're young really, really impacts, you know, of course, your adulthood and your attitude then. So I would have to, has to be my genes and my parents, right?
It makes me think like they were your sandbox that you were talking about. You want all these companies up so people feel like they can try things out and that you're always going to come back to a place that's got your back. Yeah.
Yeah. 100%. 100%. Yeah. That's a great tie back.
Great question. Thanks, Eliza. So we'll shift gears here to Tim.
Awesome. Aki, yeah, this is so just like enlightening, and I love hearing more about your journey. And something that stuck out, of course, is talking about the differences between the US and Japan. So a couple questions sort of consolidated here into one. As you stayed connected with Japan and the US for this, you know, longer period of time, how have you seen their culture shift sort of respective to each other? Has there been, are they coming closer together? Are they diverging? And then specifically with your strong connection to Japan, what types of are there learnings that you've had that have been really, really helpful as you look at your business side in the US space?
Yeah, I think they are, they're converging overall. I mean, there's obviously lots of little things moving around, but overall, my personal feeling is that they're converging. And there's good and bad for that as well. I think Japan, especially Japan, is getting more and more like the US. They are starting to learn to take some more risks. And they are, you know, learning to try new things as well. Which is not necessarily all good either, right? There's some kind of negative aspects of it. You know, there's up until now, Japan has been the society has, excuse me, had a really thick middle class, right? You had, most people were doing well, not a lot of super rich people, but also not a lot of people that were, you know, struggling to feed themselves day to day or house themselves, right? And so that was really great for society. That's starting to change now where there's more disparity between the people with money and without money. There's not a, you know, the homeless issue is not nearly as big as in Japan as it is here, but it's starting to get there. And then you also, you know, even with like food, right? Like they're starting to adopt more the Western diet. And so like being overweight is getting more common, although it's definitely not nearly as common, excuse me, as it is here. So I think overall, they are converging for better or for worse. And then, yeah, there are tons of, to your second question, I think there's a lot of things that I've learned from Japan that I use here. Kind of the whole, you know, I grew up basically American, but Japan has, you know, this kind of whole thing around rigor and, you know, making sure that everything is done correctly to a certain process. And while I don't think that's necessarily in every case, there are certain cases here, I think that should require more process and more rigor, which I kind of try to bring back from my experiences in Japan. So yeah, thank you, Tim.
Great question, Tim. Thank you. So Ryan, enough to you.
Yeah. Thanks, Aki. We're having a fun time, and it's been super interesting hearing just all your, yeah, thanks. We're wondering if you would like to turn up the adventure meter here and share any more stories about Lunch Club.
Yeah, I mean, Lunch Club is great. Like I said, I started it right about when the pandemic. That's when I discovered it. I've been doing it pretty consistently. I'll take two or three, well, one or two, maybe three meetings a week. Still, so I've probably met like 300 people now. To me, people ask me like, how do you approach it? Like, what do you get out of it? I think for me, the biggest factor for success is I go in actually with low expectations, right? And you go in with low expectations, you'll always walk out happy. Is kind of how I think about it. It's not obviously not always good for everything, but for Lunch Club, it's perfect, right? Because I'll go in, I inevitably will have 45 to 60 minutes of a good conversation with somebody new, right? You'll just talk to them about whatever it is, work, car, not cartoons, movies, books, hobbies, things like that. I always learn something new. I always feel like I've made a really good connection and had a fun time. And then I walk out, and then if it was just that, I'd be thrilled by itself. But on top of that, every once in a while, I'll meet, like the person I met at Infinity Point, right? I mean, collaborate and work together on that. I met another guy. I mean, long, circuitous thing, but I met another this Indian guy that is based in Chicago, but then moved to Mexico because he thought that the nearshoring industry was heating up. So he learned Spanish, and I learned all this thing because I've talked to him many times now since we first met. He's super into sumo, like way more than I am. So we kind of bonded over that. And then he introduced me to a partner, the Jap oh, not a Japanese, he's actually an American guy, that's living in Tokyo that he had partnered and started a company with. And he introduced me to this guy who I actually met when I was in Japan for one of my trips. And then now we're collaborating, this guy in Tokyo, he and I are collaborating on something where this Indian guy in Mexico, I've never even met in person yet. But I've talked to him now tens of times, right? Not hundreds yet, but many times we've talked and gotten really close. We could talk forever, but another thing is I run these kind of innovation workshops for a lot of my clients and investors. And in that, I like to invite kind of third parties, right? People that are not part of our company or the client's company to bring in like this external element of inspiration and newness. And I've invited people, I meet a lot of dynamic people in Lunch Club for whatever reason. And so I try to bring, I brought some of those folks into those workshops, right, where they participated both online and in person. A lot of people have showed up in person. I've met them and they participated in these workshops where they're, just brainstorming, ideating, and they have a great time. And for us, it's great because then you get a new perspective on things that you might not have thought about when you've got your head down in the problem day to day. So, yeah, I mean, if you're interested in meeting like kind of random new people, I think it's still a great platform. Although, obviously we're able to go out now, so there's a lot more options. But Lunch Club is kind of an easy way to, have an hour or two a week to do something slightly different and possibly have, walk away with something massively interesting or just great. But it's always been good.
Great question, Ryan. Network effect, right? Just at bats. Just
Yeah.
meet as many people as possible and find the interconnectedness. Toussaint, you got a question?
Yeah, and I think you got at this a little bit earlier, Sam, but Aki, like, thank you for sharing, first of all. I mean, so much enlightening,
Yeah, thank you.
rich. It sounds like your sort of connections and understanding of these two different cultures and worlds, like American culture and Japanese culture, has been an opportunity and has been a strength at this phase. Has there been times when it didn't feel like that, whether being someone of Japanese culture in America or being an American in Japan? And can you talk a little bit about if there was stuff to work through, how that's added,
Oh,
you have to control now?
tons. Yeah, we haven't talked about any of that at all, but yeah, I mean, there is a lot of that, right? Like growing up, being Asian, like I said I thought I was white, but I was not, right? I mean, I was Asian growing up in the middle of Texas, so there's a certain, it wasn't horrible, but there's a certain amount of racism, and you don't get as successful with the ladies when you're a minority. So yeah, I mean, I struggled with that a lot growing up. And then on the other side too, as I said, like once you leave Japan, you're never going to be Japanese again. you know, you're kind of out. And so if when I'm in Japan, it would be really, really, really difficult for me to become Japanese again, like for people to say, oh, this is a regular Japanese guy, right? Even if my language is perfect, and they just don't look at you like that. And I think when I was younger, that probably would have been tough for me to accept. I realized that after, you know, one of the good things about going there after I was much older is I had enough kind of experience to be able to process that. And so I realized, like, as soon as I got there, oh, you know, I'm never going to fit in here perfectly. I decided that's fine, right? That's cool. I'm just going to accept that right off the bat. I'm not even going to push back on that. And then further, we were just discussing, I started thinking about how can I use that to my advantage, right? How can I use the fact that I'm not Japanese to get things done that Japanese people couldn't do, right? And then I really started digging into that. And I feel like I figured out a pretty good, so whenever I talk to a lot of other Japanese Americans that are interested in doing work between the US and Japan, I give them, you know, try to give them a lot of advice from my experiences. I think there were definitely challenges on both sides. But then I realized being able to accept those, and then better yet, not only accept it, but then use that to then how to figure out how that can be good for you, you know, is probably the best thing to do. That was at least for me, that was the best thing to do. And then now part of my purpose and what I like to do is try to help young people that are also grappling with those things. Because I in my community, there are a lot of Japanese Americans or Japanese that have come here, or they want to come to, you know, the Bay Area, meet up with those. So I try to pass on a lot of that as much as I can.
Thanks.
That's powerful, Aki. It's just kind of leaning into your full self, right? And accepting all the beauty.
That's right. Is,
your time, talent, your energy. So that's probably just the right segue into the final question here. Just so if you're thinking, and you kind of just answered the question, but I'll ask it again to get a different take on it. So if you're thinking about somebody who aspires to live with intention, whether they're Japanese American or just in general, you know, what steps would you encourage them to take, to just lead and live with more intention overall?
Yeah, I think, for me, it's always been about balance. I always try to not get too, you know, you have to kind of really focus on certain things, obviously, to get things done. But at the end of the day, I think then it's about swinging back and trying to get that balance again on the other side. And so, you know, when I moved to Japan, I spent a lot of time just learning the language and learning the culture and just like overly, like spent a lot of time there. But I think I got to a certain point, I realized that this is about as much as I should do before I kind of ruin the rest of my, you know, my personal life and my marriage. And so then I swung back the other way and said, okay, this is good enough. Now I'm going to focus on something else. And I think it's about balance and finding your purpose and being purpose-driven is great. But if you're only doing that, I think you kind of throw yourself out of whack, right? You also have to do things that you enjoy doing, right? You have to do things that you feel like you can add value. And so being able to take different components and different pieces of your interest and your experiences and what you're good at, and then mixing those all up. And then hopefully that is, you know, has a good combination of being purpose-driven and values create, you know, value creating, but also something that you enjoy doing and find people that you enjoy doing it with, and that you're able to, you know, uniquely provide kind of impact and value. So I think it's like balancing and then trying to take all these little different components, mixing them up, and then figuring out what works best for you.
Yeah. So to bring it all the way back to the three core values, I mean, adventure is definitely in there. It's like the adventurous spirit, but then, you know, the combination of optimism that adventure is going to somehow manifest in terms of like a due north and being like kind to others, but also probably kind to yourself. In that journey. So thank you, Aki. This was a wonderful conversation. Really appreciate you and appreciate you sharing. And thanks to everybody for your questions.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. It was a lot of fun.